Hello and welcome to the Oxford Martin School. We're the ideas partner for the Oxford Literary Festival this year, so we're delighted that you can come to our newly refurbished building. Just a couple of housekeeping things. If I could ask you all to turn your phones to silent, please, that would be fantastic. Also, there are no fire alarm bells scheduled, so if you do hear the fire alarm, if you can leave by this door over here and down the stairs that you came up. And I will hand you over to Professor Ian Golden.
Thanks very much, and thanks to you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to not only be able to introduce my book today, but also to be able to welcome you to the Oxford Martin School and to celebrate the Ideas Partnership that we've launched with the Oxford Literary Festival. And we're delighted to be able to do that. So this is a building dedicated for ideas that make a difference. And our partnership with the Oxford Literary Festival is about that. This is also the inaugural Princeton lecture in partnership with the Literary Festival. So I want to thank Princeton for selecting me, if they did that, to talk about this book, The Butterfly Defect, which is hot, literally hot off the press, was air freighted from the warehouses here, and in fact, this is the only place in the world you can actually buy it for the next month. It's also, therefore, the first time I'm talking about this book in public, so I'm enjoying that, and it will be memorable for me. The reason I wrote The Butterfly Defect, Why Globalization Creates Systemic Risk and What We Can Do, is because I think that globalization is the most progressive force that the world has ever seen. And by globalization, I mean connectivity, I mean integration, I mean the opening up of countries, and not only to the flow of goods and services and physical connectivity, but most importantly, to ideas, the ability of ideas to travel. And of course, when one's in a literary festival, that's manifest because we have ideas from all over the world here. This has been a process which has happened at various times in history, but really the wave that we've experienced over the last 25 years or so, which is the period since the Berlin Wall came down, has been unprecedented in its scale, in terms of its global reach, as well as its pace of change. And so about 85 countries have become democratic in this short period of time. Walls have come down everywhere. And with that, the way that ideas travel and the way that societies have been connected is really unlike anything that's ever happened before. We can learn a lot from previous waves of globalization. One of the things we learn is that they are reversible, that this isn't a one-way process, and there have been previous waves which led to really disastrous outcomes. So I'm very interested to think about what's happening and how it can be sustained. And I'm particularly interested in that because I believe that this process of connectivity and integration has led to the most rapid reduction in poverty in the history of humanity. It's led to the most rapid improvement in livelihoods, in people's lives around the world. And this is this can be measured in many, many ways depending on what interests you. But things like life expectancy are pretty fundamental to most people, has increased by about 20 years over this period on average around the world. It took from the Stone Age to the 1970s to get an average increase of 20 years in global life expectancy. Can be measured in literacy, which is another wonderful way of accessing ideas, which is, so illiteracy has gone down in the world over this period of time from about half the people in the world to now less than 20%. Less than a fifth of the world being illiterate. Just a most remarkable, exciting thing if one believes in the power of literature and of reading, generally of education. And as part of this process, the number of desperately poor people, which the World Bank defines as people living under a dollar a day, has gone down by about 300 million people in the world, even though the world's population has increased by about 2 billion people. And the world's population has increased because life expectancy has increased, because infant mortality has gone down, because people have got their vaccinations, because they've learned things like washing your hands prevents communicable diseases, etc. So it's a most remarkable time. But I believe that it's far from sure that it will continue. And there are different ways of thinking about this. But what really crystallized this in my mind was and is the financial crisis, which was the super spreading of bads through globalization very, very rapidly around the world. And so events that were very particular to the US became very rapidly a very global problem, which of course to this day is having a devastating impact on the lives of people around the world, not least in the UK. So how does one have the good without the bad? How does one open and become more and more connected, but not more and more vulnerable? And how do we do that in ways that bring society with us? And I'm very worried, and you see this in the politics of the UK at the moment, that if we don't succeed in managing this dual of globalization, the good and the bad, that people will slam the door shut. And we see that in the politics of the UK. UKIP, the Independence Party, getting 24% of the vote. Scotland wanting to pull out of the UK. Protectionism, nationalism, of course, dramatically reflected on attitudes to migrants, but also in many, many other ways. In fact, as we get more and more joined up, societies seem to want to get more and more disconnected, withdrawing both in terms of policies, but also psychologically, becoming more local. And if you look at different indicators of the way that people think about the issues that affect them, it's actually not becoming more joined up in many cases, becoming more local. So there's this tension between a hyper-globalized real world, where everything that affects us is more and more connected, and our politics and psychology, which are more and more local and close to us. And how that tension unfolds, I believe, will determine our future. Now, the financial crisis was devastating, but it's not the biggest risk. There are much more serious things out there. Although one doesn't really want to rank these terrible tragedies. Climate change, pandemics, these things really will kill us. And so, the ability to deal with this unintended consequences of globalization becomes extremely important. So in the book, I take a journey from first trying to understand what complexity is all about and integration. And there's a big literature on it. And the reason it's called the butterfly defect is obviously a play on Lorenz's concept of a butterfly effect. And the idea is that a hurricane that flaps its wings somewhere above the US can cause a hurricane in Vietnam. This idea that small perpetrations somewhere can escalate and amplify and lead to very big ones elsewhere. And of course, one of the ways that we found this, and I had the joy of going to Jeremy Paxman's lectures afternoon, is of course the First World War. Very strange how small events lead to earth-shattering bigger cascades through a whole series of unintended consequences, often accidents of history. So that's Lorenz. For me, it's a defect because I don't like it, because I see this as a very serious problem of integration and connectivity. And as we create this increasingly integrated system, we're creating the defect. We are building the vectors of the destruction, whatever it is, financial systems, airline traffic and pandemics, cyber systems and cyber attacks, etc. So how do we manage the one without the good? And complexity brings with it a whole series of other issues. There's a big literature on complexity, and I'm very fortunate in the Oxford Martin School that we have a wonderful group working on complexity that I've been able to draw on. One of the problems of complexity, as more and more actors engage, is that attribution of cause and effect gets more and more difficult. Identifying the source of something and its eventual impact. And one of the reasons politics is getting more and more local and people are wanting to shut down is they want to be able to look at the cause of their problems in the eyeball and say to the politicians or the bankers or whatever, I know you. You're local. I can hold you to account. And this problem of hyper-globalization is one of a decreasing ability to attribute cause and effect, to be able to hold individual actors to account, because the whole thing is just so complicated. So how do you manage it? And how do you manage this, you know, multiple causes, as in climate change, with very broad effects? So there's a series of questions which come about. Another big question that I have been grappling with is about individual rationality and collective outcomes, which I deal with extensively in the book. And there are many manifestations of this which become more and more difficult the more connected we become. The classic case is the one of the commons. Those of us that live in Oxford know Port Meadow. It's a classic commons. It was used for people to put their cattle on, their goats on. It was managed effectively. And as Oxford got richer, it could no longer sustain the village. And of course, rules and regulations had to be put in place about the use. This is not a new problem. How do you manage common resources? But when you have 7 billion people, an increasing share of who have individual rights and choices and make their own decisions, who are rapidly climbing the income and choice curve, then the problem gets amplified very, very rapidly. And so we have these many, many examples, which I talk about in the book. Examples like, of course, the classic ones of overfishing, a tuna being sold for $1.7 million in the Tokyo fish market earlier this year. People being prepared to pay extinction prices, basically, for sushi or for rhinoceros horn, etc. And of course, the market doesn't know anything other than scarcity value. The poor old rhinoceroses and tuna don't know how valuable they are and multiply more because they're worth more. They simply become extinct. But there are many other manifestations. Antibiotic resistance is another good example of this. What's rational for individuals to take more antibiotics or to give their loved ones antibiotics, when we all do it, they will become ineffective. More and more choice, an individual choice leading to which is right for the individual often, leading to collectively disastrous outcomes. Now, I'm not suggesting, and I've got lots of studies in the book which show this, that governments are wiser than individuals necessarily. And there are many cases, the Aral Sea and many others, where countries doing the right things for their citizens lead to collectively bad outcomes. And of course, we see that very graphically now with climate change, particularly for fossil fuel exporting countries. Saudi Arabia's, US is becoming a fossil fuel exporter, etc. Countries can get wealthier. They can give their citizens a better life by keeping electricity very cheap and exporting it, using it to fuel coal to fuel their energy systems. But when everyone does that, you get dramatic climate change. Now, one of the joys of being in the Oxford Martin School is that this is an extremely interdisciplinary community. We have 350 people here working from the frontiers of medicine on issues like pandemics, on the sciences, and in many, many areas of the social sciences, economics, demography, and others. And so I've been fortunate to be able to listen to them and try and learn. And what the book tries to do is look across multiple different areas and think about how globalization and integration play out in different dimensions and then learn common lessons. So although I come from finance and that is the starting point, I also look at ecology, at health, in infrastructure like transport and energy systems. And I'm very concerned with politics and social cohesion and with international relations and global governance. And in each of these same tensions become manifest. Now, in the financial crisis, there were really five critical failures. And I believe that all of these, to varying degrees, also will be manifest in other areas of systemic risk. The first is the most extraordinary technological changes underneath it: computing power, fiber optics, and other technologies, which enabled the system to create new instruments which were totally unknown in the 1980s. By the 1990s, credit derivatives, credit default swaps, other instruments. And so suddenly, these new instruments, we found in retrospect, were creating exposure which was 10 times the total value of the world economy. No one knew. Now, the great puzzle about no one knowing is that finance is by far the best of the global systems. And I don't say that only out of the normal arrogance of economists. I say that because if you look at the Bank of England or the Treasury in the UK or the international equivalents like the IMF and the BIS and other institutions, these are the elite. They have the most money. They actually print the money, so of course they don't have a problem with budgets. The one thing you never find is budget cuts in the banks of Bank of England or the Treasury. The Fed Reserve in the US, the Treasury, these are very powerful institutions, much more powerful than the transport ministries or the health ministries or the education ministries or any other ministries. And they're very competitive to get into, partly because they print the money and pay their people so well. So, for example, in the IMF Young Professional Program, you have something like 5,000 applicants for 20 jobs. These are not stupid people. They're also very joined up. They will play golf together at Jackson Hole once a year, things like that. This is a global elite. They have enormous amounts of data. There's, you know, anyone that studies the financial system knows the reporting requirements at the local and global level. So how is it that the system, which has such smart people with such good institutions with so much data, allowed, and actually their mission, their primary mission, is financial stability at the national and global level? How is it that they so dismally failed to achieve their mission? And the reason, I believe, is firstly because they didn't understand the technologies, had no clue. So you read these statements from people like Alan Greenspan, Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary in the US, that led Lehman Brothers going, basically saying we didn't know what was going on. So this is quite extraordinary. And that's because it was basically old men and kids playing, and the disconnects, like we don't understand what our kids are doing. They didn't understand what their kids were doing. But their kids were playing with what Warren Buffett called weapons of mass destruction. Secondly, because there was a party going on that everyone was enjoying, and no one was going to take away the punch bowl. Short-term bonuses, political euphoria, consumer hype, these were nice things to have. And so there was a real conflict of interest, of incentives, both in the politics of short-termism and in the bonus and institution culture that made it impossible to stop. And thirdly, because there was capture intellectually of economics, which allowed people to say that this was rational and it's a social interest. And economics as a profession failed dismally. Didn't always fail. If you read the classics of John Stuart Mill and Adam Smith, these people understood political economy and society and ethics and all of those. They were absolutely integral to the writings of the classical economists. But in this period of hyper-globalization, of adrenaline, that was all lost. And so economics became an excuse for bad behavior. Markets unleashed on willing societies. And not just in the US, of course, Gordon Brown and others also drank the Kool-Aid. So you take these things together, and it's about an absolute failure to be able to drink from the fire hydrant of data and information. There's a lot of people that go around, and in fact, there's a new act in the US, the Dodd-Frank Act, that's pushing for more data, a whole new data reporting center. I think this is misguided. The problem is not the absence of data, it's an absence of will and understanding, comprehension, and what society wants to do with institutions, how it wants to manage globalization. And so what I take away from the financial crisis is this question of how do you manage complexity? How do you manage integration? Because I believe it's very good. I believe it's a good for the world that there are financial institutions that operate globally, that they are able to provide financial products and services around the world. The question is, how do you manage them? I then go on to look at a whole series of other areas of and try and learn the lessons. The book was being written at a time when this Icelandic volcano with an unpronounceable name exploded. And of course, it led to very, very major disruption of airline traffic and then spillover effects on supply chains and many other things. Now, of course, that volcano had erupted 100 years ago, 200 years ago. It had no impact. The reason it had an impact was because of connectivity, was because of airline traffic, was because an artery of our system became severed. But not only there, throughout Europe, flights were grounded, etc. And you began to get a sense of how dependent we are on these infrastructure systems. And that's just one of them, but there are many, many others. Lots of other events, the tsunami in Japan, the floods in Thailand, Hurricane Sandy, provide these sorts of examples. The floods in Oxford, try getting to London a few weeks ago. They all provide an indicator of how fragile these infrastructure systems are and how dependent we've become on the connectivity. Now, when you combine these infrastructure fragility questions with the supply chain questions, you get a very, very dangerous mix, because supply chains have become increasingly fragmented and elongated. So anything that we consume, the food, the products and services, or that our factories, like the mini factory up the road, produce, require constant supply of products from increasingly distant places. And so disruption of supply chains and disruption of infrastructure and people's travel has greater and greater spillover consequences. And so these spillovers that become important. Now, what's interesting about this is a lot of these systems are basically semi-autonomous in a sense, that there's no one is paying for the spillover effects if they don't work. If the rail system between here and London breaks down, the government doesn't have to pay all of our lost earnings and all the factories' lost earnings, etc. So these are not caught up in the valuation of it. And of course, this isn't only about the private sector. It's also about the way that the public sector is moving. And this is the whole discussion around management accounting, lean and mean, quarterly reporting, mark to market, sweat your assets, these sorts of concepts of business practice, which have become absolutely ubiquitous, not only in the private sector, but in the public sector too. So the amount of oxygen bottles in the JR hospital, or the amount of spare parts in the mini factory, really matters to the way that management is viewed in these institutions. And leaner is better. Less spare capacity is better, wherever you are, public or private. You don't want working capital tied up. This means that the system becomes more and more taut and fragile, brittle. And so when a small shock somewhere happens, it very quickly escalates. Policies also do matter. So for example, policies which remove the antitrust, anti-monopoly legislation in the US allowed a concentration of microprocessing in the affected area in Japan for the tsunami. That would not have been legal before 1980, to allow 99% of production by one firm in one place in the world. That becomes part of the deregulatory environment. So deregulation, when it leads to this concentration risk, can also compound the problem. So I look at infrastructure, I look at supply chain, I'm very interested in the internet, which is the archetypical global infrastructure with no management at all to speak of, basically a system which is an orphan of global governance, which is under severe threat now, I think. It's very difficult to imagine our lives without the internet, even for a day. Get rather anxious. Of course, your phones wouldn't work either. But that is an issue that we need to think about, because the potential is there. Health, there are many things to say. Of course, health is always the most important thing to us. It's always been the biggest killer of humanity. Spanish flu, no one really knows. Killed somewhere between 18 and 50 million people. The fact no one knows is indicative of how different it was then. We don't even know what countries it was in. Now, of course, whatever happens somewhere happens everywhere. If you've seen this movie Contagion, that's basically the story. Small events happening in one place, spreading around the world with unknown, potentially catastrophic consequences. Our pandemic group, our emerging infections group in the Oxford Martin School, has done modeling which shows that anything will be everywhere in 48 hours, with places like Heathrow and JFK and others becoming the super spreaders of not only the goods of travel, but the bads. So how do you manage this, and how do you get your head around it? The environment and ecologies, another example of globalization's dual effect. Because what's happening, of course, is as more and more people get lifted out of poverty, they're consuming more and more, and the planetary boundaries are being pushed more and more aggressively. Now, I believe it's ethically, politically, and otherwise absolutely wrong to say to people in the rest of the world who haven't yet gone up the development trajectory, sorry, the atmosphere's full, the oceans are depleted, the land's exploited, you know, you can't have your resources, or you can't have your food, or you can't burn your energy. I believe that is not a tenable option. So we have in this, I think, the biggest challenge of individual and collective action, because it really requires that those of us that are come up this curve, who are benefiting from incomes now, which give us very decent lives, are going to have to make much greater sacrifices in terms of our resource use than those that are still climbing and at the bottom of these curves. So this is another example where if you want globalization to work, you really need to move from individual choice to more coordinated and collective action. Now, I have written, this is my fourth book on globalization. The first one was on development. The second was on migration. The third was on global governance. And this is, I think, the last in the set, which is on the other side, the dark side of globalization. The others are all much more optimistic. But the one on global governance, which is called Divided Nations, why global governance is failing and what we can do about it, is really trying to think about, is it possible to imagine that in this hyper-connected world, we can also get a more global way of managing the world? And that's really where the rubber hits the road, as it were, with these systemic questions, because they do require very integrated management. Now, there's a number of things that can be said about that. The first is that it's very difficult to imagine, except after a lot of very good wine, international governments coordinating and global governance or global parliament or anything like that having any effect. In fact, the more choice people have and the more countries there are, the less probable that seems as an outcome. So although we love the UN, or I love the UN, I wouldn't, if I was a Syrian, I wouldn't be looking to save my life or and I certainly won't be looking to stop climate change or the next financial crisis or anything else. So how does one do it then? How does one make globalization work? Well, part of the problem, I believe, is to ensure that our societies feel that there's something in it for them. And actually, the problem starts at home. Now, globalization has unfortunately led to growing inequality, both within countries and between countries. And the reason is that the benefits are so enormous. The returns to education and to being connected are so great that if you don't have them, you get left further and further behind. If you don't get on the train, it goes further and further away from you. So the absolute poverty for many people has been reduced. There is a group of well over a billion people who are suffering absolutely dire poverty, and their chances of escaping poverty might not be any greater now than they were in 1990. And that's because they're disconnected. They're living in the Sahel, or they're living in a government, a country like Angola, which is hyper-connected, but where a kleptomanic leadership captures all the benefits and doesn't share them. Infrastructure divides, other divides, education divides. So that's one sort of problem. But leaving that one aside, within, if you take out the tail of these 25 countries or so where most of the desperately poor people live, there's still growing gaps, particularly within countries. And we see that in the UK, we see it in the US, we see it in Europe, and we see it around the world. Certainly, I just got back from China yesterday. You certainly see it in China. Does it matter? Do we care about relative poverty or absolute poverty? Do we care how many billionaires there are in our society, or do we care how many people are starving? I care more about how many people are starving. I don't really care about how many Ferraris there are in the street or bling. But if I think they're connected, then I care. And what there's a growing evidence around is that actually beyond certain levels of inequality, it becomes self-reinforcing, because but in democracies, but also in non-democracies, there's more billionaires in the Chinese Central Committee than there is in the US Senate. There's a capture of policy by wealth, and that leads to a very toxic spiral. It's a spiral which is destructive of attempts to support redistribution, but it also leads to slower innovation in societies, because those on the inside prevent new challenges, new ideas. And so inequality is a big obstacle to people feeling that in a society which is socially cohesive, that they have a shared stake. If you speak to the people in the north of England, or the 60% youth unemployed in Spain or elsewhere, and ask them what they think about globalization, I think they'll give you a very short answer, which won't be as polite as "it's rubbish." And you can understand why they feel that. It's done nothing for them. It's destroyed their lives in many cases. And that's why I believe we're seeing this reaction against the other. People recognize that there's a threat out there. There's a threat of financial crises. There's a threat of unemployment. There's a threat of people elsewhere maybe taking your jobs. There's a threat of pandemics. There's a threat of cyber attacks. There's a threat of terrorism. There's lots of threats. And it's very convenient to believe that they come from over there. It's the foreign or the other. It's the globalized. It's that out there. And so coming back, nationalism, xenophobia, protectionism, is a response. Now the problem with this dynamic is that one cannot get a management of globalization out of it, because actually all, and I'd say the top 5 or 10 factors that affect all of our lives and our children's lives, future of the UK, will come from over there. It'll be the ideas, It'll be the positives, the capital, the innovation, the jobs, the attractions, and it'll be the negatives, the pandemics, the cyber attacks, the financial crises, etc., the climate change. So unless we join up more, we'll have less control over the future of our lives. The question is how? So I believe this issue of inclusion and how societies feel their identity as being together in it and being together with the rest of the world is absolutely central to the way that we'll be able to do it. Because I don't believe in world government, because I'm rather cynical about the existing global institutions, having spent a lot of my life in them, wonderful places, but I don't see them as up to the task of meeting these sorts of challenges that I've been outlining. I brought together a group of really wonderful people with lots and lots of scars on their back who had run some of these institutions who are committed to a better world, and a very strange, diverse range of people, ranging from a very senior Chinese minister, an Indian minister, to Michelle Bachelet, who's just become the president of Chile, and a whole lot of other people, created something called the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations, and our report now for the long term is on our website. But the basic question was, knowing all of this, what would you do? You know? And these are not the people that would say create world government or something. So I've been criticized for not including more young people or different groups. Basically, I wanted people that had been there, that had been in the kitchen, who were not idealistic, but who were ambitious. And there's a series of recommendations which I embrace and partly have in The Butterfly Defect and talk about how you manage a hyper-connected and globalized world. Create coalitions of different sorts of actors, like cities, like corporates, like countries that are prepared to do things and build widening circles of support. How you internalize the externalities or the spillover effects of negative consequences. So how do we manage climate change? How we need to ensure as well that we don't simply export our pollution. The Germans might feel great about the fact they're cutting out their coal power. But does it matter if they're just buying it from Poland? Or they might feel great about not having nuclear. They're just buying it from France. Having a joined-up view, in the same way that California, we've done looked at some analysis. California is wonderful. It's going very green, and its carbon emissions are being greatly reduced. But a lot of part of that, not all of it, part of it is the export to other states or to other countries of the dirty stuff and just buying it in. So we need to realize that we're in one world, that we're in it together. It doesn't actually matter where these things happen. And being joined up is extremely important in the way we think about it. Understanding cradle to grave structures on products and services, embedding them in the food labeling or the car labeling or whatever we're buying, getting more knowledge so we can make better decisions. The other thing I emphasize in the book is that you cannot fight complexity with complexity. And one of the great challenges, not least in finance, in regulation, is how do you manage these hyper-complex systems without creating monsters of regulation, which will soon be outdated, just like the past ones. And I believe, for example, in finance, that the Basel III regulations, which are currently being put in place to manage banking, are completely unfit for purpose, as is the Dodd-Frank Act in this respect. These are lawyers' and management accountants' dreams. They will keep buildings full of people occupied, trying to understand the regulations, interpret them for the different clients, and then game them. But would they have stopped the previous financial crisis? Well, if you run the data through, actually they wouldn't have. Will they stop the next one? I doubt it. It partly depends where you think the next crisis is coming from. But let's say it's going to come maybe not from finance, but from a link between these different complex systems. Say a pandemic in Canary Wharf or in Wall Street, or a Hurricane Sandy that really does take out Wall Street, or some other sort of event. Then think about these regulations and their effectiveness. So I believe we need to think a lot more about geography, about competition policy, about where things are and how resilient they might be and how connected they might be as part of this. Would you rather have your money in a local bank or a lot of local banks that are all co-located on one high street? Or would you rather have it in a globally diverse institution? Those are the sorts of questions we need to ask ourselves. In regulation, we need to ask ourselves whether we can trust our intuition. Andy Haldane at the Bank of England has this wonderful metaphor about the dog that caught the frisbee, which is when you throw your ball or a frisbee and the dog always catches it, it's not because it understands Newtonian physics or anything like that. It's because it just keeps its eyes on it constantly. And so you don't need very complex theories often. You can trust judgment. When I was working in Washington, of course, I didn't see the financial crisis coming either, although it was brewing. I one day asked the cleaner how they were, and they said they were feeling great. They just bought a second home near Miami. I said, that's great. If I just thought for a minute about the impossibility of this and what it meant for society, and I'm sure the cleaners in the Fed Reserve and in the Treasury were saying the same things to their bosses. Simple intuition, the view of how societies are working and what they should be working like. Trusting ethics, you see the banking bonuses and what was happening. When suddenly it goes from being, bankers go from being paid 20 times the lower paid workers to 2,000 times the lower paid workers. Do we need regulations to tell us that something weird's happening here in society, when it goes from being 5% of UK GDP to 20% over a very short period of time? Do we think that's sustainable? So I believe that we can be blinded by the blizzard of complexity, by the blizzard of data, by the blizzard of information. And that in that process, we retreat from trusting judgment, from trusting simplicity, and trusting intuition. And I believe we have to be guided much more about that. We will not be able to manage the future with some sort of dashboard of increasingly sophisticated data where you push a button when the red light goes on. It's much too complex and surprising for that. We'll increasingly have to smell it, have to feel in an intuitive way about what's right and act on it. And I believe that that's important. We also do need to trust science and what we know. One of the most bizarre things I find at the moment is the skepticism around climate change. You know, we have to understand the urgency of it, not because it's going to happen necessarily now, because if we don't act on it, you cannot unravel it. For every day that it carries on, it gets much more complicated to unravel. So these time-critical paths where things are happening and building, that every time you postpone, you have a big problem. Now, in climate change, coalitions also provide, I believe, if not the answer, a long way towards it. Something like 8 countries account for 90% of global carbon emissions. About a dozen account for something like 93%. So why do we need a global agreement of 202 countries to stop carbon emissions? And the answer is because we care about legitimacy. I think we've been very damaged by coalitions of the willing. But I believe that that is the way that we have to go forward. That we, people, countries, cities, need to act and not wait for global agreement. If you want to manage these global forces, we have new global constituencies. And one of the disconnects that I point to in the book is this totally integrated global system with citizens on Facebook and in other ways integrated as well, operating as if the Westphalian system of hundreds of years ago in terms of governments still having to make all the decisions, agreeing anything before they feel empowered to act. So cities, individuals, in the US, states, these are very powerful new constituencies. And in fact, if one got an alliance of the biggest cities with a small number of countries and states, one can probably affect about 50% of global carbon emissions. So if we believe in things, we need to act. There's some things that do require global agreement. I believe that cybersecurity, for example, requires global agreement. I believe that pandemics require global agreement, the management of them, because they can come from anywhere, and we need a global system which monitors people and their health everywhere and identifies at source the risk and is able to neutralize it. That's the only way to deal with pandemics. Once it escapes through an airport, basically you're finished. But that's not true in climate, and it's not true in finance, and it's not true in other areas where a small number of actors play an extremely large global role in the manifestation of these risks. In the end, I want to leave 10 minutes for discussion. In the end, what this comes down to is that actually the greatest risk is none of these things I've talked about in terms of finance, pandemics, cyber. It's ourselves. The greatest risk is our failure to comprehend globalization. Our failure to comprehend that we're in a totally joined up system. We are joined at the hip to the rest of humanity in ways that were just unimaginable in the past. And it's this failure of us to move in our mindsets into a global world where we are connected, that's the greatest risk. Because increasingly we act as if our individual choice and our local actions are enough. So in part what the book is about is that. It's to say, I hope that we can spread a wider understanding of this common humanity, this most extraordinary, marvelous time in history we're in, this most wonderful period with potential which is unlike that of any. There's no reason why poverty and disease cannot be eliminated in our lifetimes. But it's also the most dangerous period, because the very sources of our innovation and our success threaten to unravel and cause our destruction. And it's the understanding of this dual. You cannot have the one without the other. You cannot be connected and open and integrated without also being vulnerable and suffer from connectivity. We know that in our personal, emotional relationships with people. We know that when we open up, we become more vulnerable. But it's also true in the material world, and it's true in the virtual world of ideas. So managing this and getting our heads around it, I believe, is absolutely central to the future. And that's why I wrote the book, and I hope it's useful to you if you read it. Thanks very much. We have 10 minutes. This is being filmed, so if you don't want to be recorded, I suggest you don't say anything. And if you don't want your face to be seen, I'm sorry. I'm sure everyone will like it. So there's a microphone. Clara has a microphone. Just put up your hand, and there's another microphone there. Have I stunned you all into silence? Sorry, take the mic.
You started very rightly saying about the problems that were caused by lack of knowledge, and you brought it right the way round to it being down to ourselves. So how do you see the role of artificial intelligence being a huge disconnect in everything that you've said?
Yeah. There's let me just touch on maybe one or two or three areas, and we have a wonderful group, a number of wonderful groups in the Oxford Modern School working on artificial intelligence. One thing which is really fascinating is the use of artificial intelligence, by which I mean machine intelligence, to solve problems that we can't solve, but also to the interface. So our citizen science projects, for example, Galaxy Zoo is a very good example. I encourage you to look at the website, the Zooniverse. You know, we've discovered more universes in the last year than we discovered in the previous 50 years. By a handover between humans and machines, machines scanning using the Hubble data, the skies, and then asking humans to interpret some data, and the humans teaching the machines to become more intelligent in about the way they interpret it. So that's one sort of thing. Problem solving, understanding, and the interface between the way that machines are able to identify problems in humans and them teaching each other is very exciting, and maybe in the end it'll stop a financial crisis. It certainly is the way, for example, you'd stop a pandemic by having sensors with this sort of machine interface and with humans in it, I think. The second question is what jobs are machines going to take? Okay, and one of my colleagues in the Oxford Martin School has written a paper which suggests that 47% of jobs will be lost in the next 20 years. Now that's a massive, massive issue, not least for inequality and social cohesion and people's views of technology and their preparedness to accept it or try and shut down even more. So how that, whether that's going to happen, how it's going to happen, how you manage it, what new jobs will be created, those are extremely important questions that we're working on. And the third is the sort of part that I don't actually go for, but I do have colleagues that do, which is sort of runaway machine intelligence. That this is a threat. Okay. This sort of, my version from my generation was 2001 Space Odyssey. but that's basically where you get singularity, where machines become more important than humans, or more intelligent than humans. I don't believe that's right, because I believe that they're complementary. I actually do believe you can always pull the plug out. And that they're complementary. It's different sorts of analysis and analytics. Machines, I don't believe in our lifetimes, I mean, I would never say never, can experience tenderness, love, emotion, the most important things for humanity. Would you want a machine to look after you when you're ill? Some things, monitoring, maybe, doing various things, but there's a whole series of issues around machines and humans which I believe mean they're not fungible in the end. That's a big conversation.
In relation to the financial crisis of power being in the hands of the old men. And I wondered, in terms of educating young people, particularly at sort of school, where the old men have determined the curriculum, what impact would you like to see to prepare the sort of younger generation to cope better with the issues that you're talking about?
Yeah. The pace of change is so rapid on technologies, on many of these things, that I'm increasingly of the view that we're going to have lifelong learning, and also we're going to have to stay in the labor markets. I mean, I don't know what age you are, but my age, you know, I think I'll still have retirement as a concept. I still have to real worry about Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Our children don't have those concepts. They're going to have to work into their 80s or 90s, and they're gonna, you know, so what they've learned in 2014 is not going to be highly relevant or useful, perhaps in 2070. The base, and this is where you get in terms of the ability to learn, the ability to interpret, the ability to connect, the ability to drink from the fire hydrant of data. Those are the real skills, I think, which become absolutely important, as well as the hungerness for learning, the desire to keep retooling and kidding, the love of learning. Those are things, I believe, which become the most important attributes of what you can teach people at school. I also do think that we're increasingly seeing the need for interdisciplinarity. Incredibly strong science base, but equally ethics, etc. A whole other conversation. I'm very sensitive. This room used to be the history library, and now it's the 21st century school, so there's slight sensitivities here. But learning from history and how one engages with these things, I think, is extremely important. Let's take maybe two more, and then I think we are going to have to stop. Yeah.
Thank you very much. As you look forward into the next two or three decades and these sort of tensions that you've been describing between globalization and the wish for localism, as it were, do you have a sense of what kind of political ideologies, political philosophies may emerge as the dominant ones? And I mean, specifically, can you offer any words of comfort to those people who come from a kind of individualist, liberal kind of political tradition where the sovereignty of the individual is important? One feels very much under threat from encroachments into privacy and some of the things that are close to our hearts.
Yeah, I think these are extremely important and the biggest questions. There's a number of things that I would say. I think trust by whoever, in whichever institution, is going to become more and more important. So I think we're all going to want to give away data about society. I think we'll be prepared to. If we trust, that it'll give us more resilience and security. And it's about, if we think that data is going to be abused, that it's going to be used for extortion, for political gain, for whatever bad things, then it becomes more. But if we trust it, the creation of agencies which are trusted by society becomes important, I think, in that process. All the data that I've looked at, and there's some in the book, points to very rapidly declining trust in our existing institutions, particularly in political institutions, and increasing short-termism. There's also a major question of our institutions' ability to deliver the important things. You know, if you look at the education scores in the UK compared to China, if you look at the infrastructure scores, this is terrifying reading. You don't have to be an astrologist to see what the future might hold in terms of society's abilities to compete. So I think there's going to have to be a way for people, as I do, share, that believe in individual sovereignty and rights, to reconcile it with more and more individual responsibility. And it's this rights responsibility thing which is at the core of liberal dilemmas. What responsibility did you have to the rest of humanity? What responsibility did you have to the atmosphere, or to the oceans, or to people elsewhere in the world? But I think libertarianism of the extreme side, which is basically I can buy as big a car I want and guzzle as much gas or take as many antibiotics, etc., is going to be on the wane. I think people are not going to want to see such antisocial behavior. Now, different societies at different speeds, but I think in the UK we will find that happening very rapidly over the next 20 years. So I think there'll be reconciling individual freedom with collective responsibility. I think there's going to have to be, but there's going to be a tough series of compromises in that, I think. Yeah, last question.
System of government is important in this, and obviously with the rise of China, the model of the Chinese way of doing government has become one that's seen as an alternative to democracy. And I mean, do you think that matters, and which, if you do, which is sort of superior?
It's getting easier and easier. I think the system of government matters less than the effectiveness in achieving a series of goals which I really care about. Okay, what are those goals? Elimination of poverty, giving people decent, healthy lives, giving them freedoms to exercise their choice, sort of the Matthias Sen capabilities sort of concept, giving them the ability to sustain for the future. In other words, this trade-off between short and long run is extremely important. How you value the rights of future generations or how you value non-human species on Earth, for example, plants, animals, fish, in this becomes extremely important. So I believe I believe that there are many democracies which are unable to deliver, and there are many authoritarian countries that are unable to deliver. But I can also cite examples of both which are better at delivering, at least on some dimensions of this. The creation, corruption, the capture of governments by elites, whatever party they belong to, whatever system, I think is extremely dangerous. I believe that the creation of independent agencies, examples in the UK would be the Office of Budget Responsibility, groups like NICE on drugs control and drugs administration, independent regulators. These things can operate in different societies. They're independent, can be independent of the political process. Now, if you ask me, will the Chinese be more effectively able to deliver on some of these management things? Yes. China probably will have more dramatic policies on climate change than most other countries quicker, but it has to for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's the most threatened. Its people are most threatened for all sorts of reasons by it. And secondly, when I left Beijing yesterday, day before, it was 356 parts per million. It was hazardous there. You could not go out. And they only at $7,000 per capita. They're going to be doubling their income and their emissions in the next 8 years. This is not sustainable. So how they manage that? You know, they've taken shark fin soup off the official banquets. This is great news. But they can make those decisions. Those decisions can't get made in some other societies. So I think there's positives and negatives, and I'm becoming more agnostic about the top label, about whether it's autocratic or democratic, and more focused on actually what can they do about the things I care about. And I think there's a range of sins from all sorts of different countries, and there's a range of wonderful acts, and let's support the wonderful acts wherever they are. So